Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of In the Barn. I'm Robin.
And I'm Kelsey. And in today's episode, we are going to discuss the story of someone who was once thought of as the greatest horseman, perhaps in the history of the horse. His blunt sayings and his tough-to-please demeanor made him a legend in almost every barn in America. This is the story of a man who was always a narcissist, a bully, an abuser of both animals and people, and a reckless social climber. This is the story of George H. Morris. On August 5th, 2019, all the rumors about George Morris's questionable behavior with minors were finally confirmed. The United States Equestrian Federation, USEF, officially put him on the safe sport permanently ineligible or banned list, with the ability to appeal. This was an indication that USEF had been investigating violations against George Morris and that this investigation had drawn to a close. Any claims that had been made against him were considered substantiated and a violation of the newly enacted safe sport rules. Many in the horse world were notified of this decision after receiving a mysterious email with George's personal statement in it. The following statement is from the webpage of Phelps Sports, which is his PR firm. So, Wellington, Florida, August 5th, 2019. George Morris has been listed as permanently ineligible, subject to appeal by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport and the United States Equestrian Federation for violations of the Safe Sport Code or Federation rules. Individuals that receive these rulings are prohibited from participating in any activities or competitions that USEF licenses, endorses, or sponsors. Mr. Morris's official statement on the matter is as follows. I am deeply troubled by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport's findings regarding unsubstantiated charges for events that allegedly occurred between 1968 and 1972. I contest these findings wholeheartedly and am in the process of disputing them. I share our community's commitment to protecting the safety and well-being of all our athletes who need reliable guidance and encouragement at every level, of which I have provided for over 50 years. I will continue, as I always have, to proudly support equestrianism and its continued development around the world. This statement was posted and likely also written by his PR firm, Phelps Sports. It's likely that they had some sort of internal email list of riders and folks from the horse community that they sent this to. The news of George's ban broke the same day as the memorial service for another former show jump rider, Rob Gage. Rob was a former American Grand Prix Association rider of the year who was banned for life by Safe Sport on charges of sexual misconduct with minors in the late 70s and early 80s. He ended up killing himself in June as his appeal was pending.
And weirdly enough, we both went to a clinic with Rob Gage.
Oh my God, did we?
Yes.
Oh my God, we did.
Yes, we did.
Oh my God, I didn't.
Do you not remember that?
Oh my God, we totally went to Rob Gage clinic.
Yeah.
I didn't like, oh wow. I will always remember that because that clinic was like burned in my mind of like, because he had two riders doing the same exercise. Well, okay, he had one rider doing an exercise that the other rider started copying. And it was very clear that like what one rider is doing is quote training. What the other rider is doing is abuse. And they were doing the same exercise. So that like is vividly burned in my mind because I was like, that's the distinction. Emotion is what makes it abuse versus teaching. I've learned a lot since then. I kind of disagree with that. Like you could still be abusive without any emotion. But that was like burned in my mind for so long that like, as long as you're not emotional, it's okay.
And when we were auditing it, he was like he was very interactive with us and was like talking to us constantly while he was teaching and stuff. Like probably one of the more interactive clinicians I've seen with their auditors.
Yeah, but he was kind of also not. Like I do remember coming off a little bit arrogant, like a little bit of a jerk. Yeah, he committed suicide and his memorial was the exact same day as George Morris's announcement that he was also banned. Isn't that crazy?
Yikes. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a coincidence. Like, what a weird coincidence. And Rob Gage was being investigated for the exact same thing that George Morris was. And his appeal was pending. So he was, like, in the exact same place George Morris was and his memorial was that day. So I just think that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how the heck did we get here? Like, what? I think the horse world was definitely shocked. but also not shocked at all when this came out about George Morris. And that's kind of one of the reasons why we wanted to do this episode and dive into George Morris, because we're not hunter jumpers, we're eventers. So when the news broke, I remember being like, interesting, because of course we knew who George Morris was. But then I just felt like he disappeared so quickly. Like, the news broke August 5th, 2019, did I say? Yeah, 2019.
And then he was gone.
He was gone. Like, suddenly no one talked about him anymore. And it always struck me as odd, because the only reason in my mind that would happen was because everyone knew. Everyone knew it was true. And I knew nothing. Like, in 2019, I knew nothing about George Morris. The fact that he just suddenly disappeared and everyone stopped talking about him was like, I think it's true. And so we're gonna tell the story of George Morris.
I would also say I think it was really, we were pushed his name growing up so much. He was presented to you as the epitome of horsemanship. He was presented as just the ultimate horseman. Even as we were eventers, we were in eventing, we still knew his name. He had his column in Practical Horseman where he would, you know, talk about your position. I remember reading that and being like, okay, so he says to do this, I'll make sure I go and do this. So even though people knew for such a long time, I was not aware. I always had him presented to me by adults of the time, by organizations, that he was so great. And when you go and read his own book, it is so blatantly obvious that never once was he that good horseman. Never once.
Yeah, I have a lot of rage on this subject. So obviously, we do not think George Morris is innocent. We also do not think he is the legend that he was built up to be. And our dislike for him, to be completely honest, going into this episode, I knew nothing about him. I couldn't have told you what his accomplishments were. I couldn't have told you what he had done, who he was. All I could tell you was that he was, you know, you listened to him, you respected him, and he had great information and great, you know, quotes that you could share. I don't like him because of his own words. We read, yes, for this episode, we read the book Unrelenting, which is the real story, Horses, Bright Lights, and My Pursuit of Excellence. This is his autobiography. This book is horrible. This book is, his own stories are horrible. And that is why I don't like him. Not because I'm getting this information from a third party who was biased. No, I don't like him straight from George Morris's own words.
I 100% agree. And I did not know. I knew who George Morris was, that we were presented as kids, like we were supposed to, you know, idolize and take after. Mm-hmm. I had no idea any of George's background. I realize now I knew nothing about him until we started reading his book. And I'm telling you, his book kicks off already in a weird place. And his own words, the way he presents stories, doesn't reflect on things. Like, it is so hard for someone that has not read this book to comprehend how weird it is. And just, like, my God, the things that he was willing to share, what wasn't he willing to share?
I mean, there's stuff he left out on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, a lot on purpose. We did a lot of research for this episode, so we have as complete of a picture and narrative we can for a lot of these stories. I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind if you do read this book and a lot of the stories we'll share is that George is a narrator that's really not to be trusted. There's a lot of information that from his own memories is, yes, that's correct. Those events happened. His perspective may be completely off, or no, those events didn't quite happen the way you're telling us. It's clear that there wasn't a ton of fact checking done for this book. But again, if you're just, your memories are faulty. No one's memories are perfect. So a lot of these stories, I do, when I try to tell them and share them, hedge it with, this is according to George. This is his, you know what, how he spun the story.
Yes.
I think the other people involved in that story may have a very different, like, memory of what happened. So he's definitely not to be a narrator that's to be trusted. And a lot of it is he leaves out big chunks of stories as well that are like, yeah, so we also needed to know that because that was important to the story and to understanding what was going on at that time. Have a couple disclaimers. One is that George is not to be trusted as the narrator. The second is I want people to know that we are not so naive to believe that the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s, whatever, wasn't a different time. I understand that when you look back at history with today's lens and today's perspectives, you know, things are complicated, right? So I do want to say that when we read a lot of these stories, a lot of these stories are actually kind of funny. Some of them not at all. A lot of them are actually kind of funny as a one-off story. But when you start to stack them on top of each other and you tell not like these stories layered over and over and over, you see a pattern of behavior that becomes really problematic. So the excuse of, well, the 60s was a different time, I get that. But like, let's look at, you know, the bigger picture here, not just that one little story, that one little incident. If we look with a really narrow focus, yeah, it's kind of a funny story. If we broaden that lens out a little bit, that it's not, it's no longer funny. And then the third and final disclaimer is that we will be talking about the allegations against him.
Yes.
There will be a lot of discussion about sexual assault, especially in the second part of this episode. So we are going to do two parts just because there is so much to this story to tell. So we'll give warnings when we get closer to that stuff. But there will be a lot of talk about sex throughout this episode, because not because we want to go there, but because George went there. So there will be some maybe more adult content throughout this episode. But the really bad stuff will be in part two when we talk about the allegations and his victims. So with that, Robin, are you ready?
I guess I'm ready.
So let's wind that clock back to 1938, somewhere around there.
Yep. Our story of dear old George H. Morris kicks off in 1938 when he was born. He began riding at the New Cannon Mounted Troop when he was 7 years old in 1945, before eventually moving over to the Ox Ridge Hunt Club, where he rode for many years. Early on, he reflects on himself being a very high-strung kid with extreme fearful and nervous tendencies, to the point that he had anxiety attacks and nervous breakdowns as a 9-year-old boy, so much so that it resulted in him being pulled out of the fourth grade for psychological counseling.
Which is not normal. Like, that's not...
No.
Normal children don't have to go to psychological counseling at 9. Like, they don't get pulled from the fourth grade because of their mental health. That's a red flag right there, that maybe things weren't great at home. You know, something at home might be a little off.
Especially in the 40s.
Yes.
Especially in the 40s. No one in the 40s was considering mental health as anything, so... like a nervous kid would immediately be dismissed or would be given like medication or something of that nature. Like, it was not handled the way it is today.
Sure. And I think it's an indication, right, that something serious, extremely serious, was going on. But it's also an indication of the amount of money and wealth his family had that they were able to consider mental health treatment for a 9-year-old.
Yes. George was born into very, very wealthy parents and was a heavy member in, I guess, like the socialite scene there of Connecticut and New York, and was, in George's words, he like lists off tons of people that he knew or came across or ran in the same social circles with, of like high profile New York socialites.
Yes.
And was very much so involved in that lifestyle.
Yes. Yeah. I think his mother, his parents for sure, and his grandmother for sure, were very into society life.
Yes. And another example or instance of his extreme anxiety and panic attacks was when he was about to get his first horse to lease, little Pinto mare by the name of Robin. Unfortunately, that pony was jumping, I think like the week before he was going to take it on as his lease horse, was jumping and ended up somersaulting over a fence, breaking her neck and dying. And when George found out about this as a young child, he became hysterically upset, his words, not mine, to the point that his grandmother called out the local doctor to give him a shot so he would calm down. Once again, not your traditional reaction from a 9-year-old. Also, not the traditional reaction from parents.
Like, but it just makes you think, like, his parents were not stellar parents by any remarks. Like, that, it just screams to me how much attention, like, he lacked. Like, I know he goes back and forth between his mom paid him a lot of attention, but then when you're having reactions like this, it definitely feels like someone who's has been very neglected.
George doesn't quite come out and say it necessarily, but in different instances where he is describing his parents' actions, it becomes pretty apparent that his home life was not ideal. There's instances in the 50s he wouldn't win a class, and his mom would rub that failure in for days afterwards, saying how he couldn't win on his fancy horse while girls on their backyard ponies beat him. And like, these are stories George shared as like kind of funny anecdotal stories, but it wasn't. And he often follows it up with that her meaner streaks would follow when she was drinking a lot. And he eventually in the story shares that his mom was an alcoholic. It's pretty clear that he didn't have the healthiest home life.
Anyone who listens to true crime and like, you know, when you start to learn like the backstories of a lot of people who go on to commit heinous crimes, there's a lot of like similarities between their backstories and George's. Not everyone with George's backstory goes on to commit heinous crimes. Just saying there's a lot of similarities between people who like socially cannot cope.
Yes. And even while George didn't have the greatest home life, he went on to ride with one Gordon Wright at his farm, Secor Farms. The reason I mention Gordon is because Gordon is someone that shaped George so much in his younger years. Throughout his entire life, George talks about how heavily Gordon Wright influenced him, not only in his business management, but in his riding and in his horse care, which I think it's safe to say Secor Farms was not a healthy environment for horses nor kids. George elaborates that Gordon Wright fell into subpar horse care, detailing a story where George moved his horse at the time, Flying Banner, to Secor Farms, and within a short time, George's horse succumbed to botulism from moldy hay and almost died.
Yeah.
That's more than just like minor lack of horse care. That's pretty severe.
It was a three-story barn, wasn't it? So like,
yes,
I can't even like moldy hay, probably dark, cramped stalls, like airflow is probably horrible. Like it just sounds like a nasty place to live. I don't even like keeping my horses in a barn, like a big 20 stall barn that is one story. Like that's too inside for my horses, my comfort level.
And the subpar horse care there at Secor Farms is just the tip of the iceberg of the unhealthy environment for children to be surrounded in, for horses to be living in. That was Gordon Wright's style of teaching, his lifestyle. His way of teaching was very militaristic after the time he spent in the cavalry, so much so that it was to the point that his students felt as though they could not say no to him. If a kid said no or felt uncomfortable in a certain situation, he would essentially mock his students until they caved and gave in to his original demands. One of these instances was when a girl during a lesson was asked to jump her horse from the outside of the ring to the inside of the ring, and she didn't feel comfortable doing it. She didn't feel her horse had it in him. And Gordon essentially called her a coward until she was like, well, okay, I might as well try. Of course, it doesn't go well. It was a fixed fence. The horse ended up colliding with the fence, pretty much falling over the top of it. Her face collided with the ground. She had gravel embedded in her skin. She was unconscious for over an hour, and she was so scarred following this injury that people couldn't even recognize her a few weeks later.
You know, you just raised a really good point that I hadn't really thought about, is that they do talk about the military style, right, that a lot of trainers from this era had been in the cavalry, and that's right where they got their coaching and where they learned to ride. And while it may be very like technically correct, you know, in quotes, correct riding, that's a very interesting place to learn to be a teacher. As someone who, like, you have a husband in the military, do you want him to be your riding instructor or any of his?
Absolutely not. I hate whenever he tries to teach me something.
Right. So, but.
Because he always just looks at me. He's like, why didn't you do it right? I don't know. It's the first time I'm doing it.
And he loves you. So, like, imagine. Like, he has to go home with you. So he's going to be a little kinder. But, like, yeah, that's just a really interesting point to think about, that a lot of these trainers, like George, who have learned that military style, really do see that, you know, drill sergeant-esque-ness as being correct and desirable. And I think most of us have learned that that's not the best way to teach. The idea of the military is to kind of...
is that you're given an order and you don't respond, you carry out that order.
Exactly, right? It's to kind of break your natural thought process, your critical thinking thought process, and just respond to that order and do the task, which is really interesting then to bring that into the arena, because like as a trainer, that is the opposite way of how I teach. Like I want my kids to be able to go out and ride without me. And this is important because it comes back later for George, and it's actually one of the reasons that he stepped down as the manager of the U.S. riding team, is because he wants to be involved in every single aspect and give orders.
Yes, yes. And it was also remarked heavily by George that Gordon was constantly chasing women, and apparently women were constantly throwing themselves at him. Like, I mean, this is mentioned over and over and over with Gordon, And I mention this because this is in the environment that George grew up in and molded himself after. He goes so far as to say that him and Gordon were pretty much the same. Gordon just happened to chase women while he later on went to chase men.
Yeah.
This wasn't a healthy environment for kids to be growing up in or necessarily for kids to be seeing. I mean, another former student of Gordon's, after she walked in on him boning some lady in like the adjoining bedrooms to the tack room, remarked that we used to marvel that if our parents knew what we saw there, they'd be horrified. Which just goes to indicate that this was not a healthy environment for children to be surrounded by. And at this time, George was only like 12 years old.
And it's a very like, this is the time when he's learning and being impacted and molded. So he's seeing these things and thinking that's how a riding instructor operates. That's how a barn operates.
This was just the 40s. 1950 was the first year George rode in the National Horse Show, which includes the AHSA Hunt Seat Medal Finals and the ASPCA McClay Finals. 1952 is when George made history by becoming the youngest to win both the McClay and Medal Finals at the young age of 14. This is said by him to not only be career, but also a life-altering accomplishment. And this was one of those accomplishments that really launched him and his career to where he was getting new opportunities based off of this win. Unfortunately, I'm not so sure you could say George had a nice, squeaky, clean win. You see, the year before, in 1951, George qualified for the finals, but didn't get a callback. He was upset about this and decided to take advantage of the social scene he was involved in by cozying up to the judges so they would favor him. In October of 1952, George found out that the three of his mother's good friends were going to be the judges of the McClay and the Medal Finals. Since the social life and the show scene were so intertwined and his mom was already good friends with them, George nudged his mom to say hello to them over coffee, and he would encourage his dad to go and talk to the judges that were going to be judging that show because he knew the judging was subjective. And in his own words, he says, "I learned to play the game by getting into the good graces of the judges so they liked him and would favor him during the finals." And the way the finals worked at this time was that the participants would come in, they would ride the course on their own horse, and then the top five or so would be given a callback. And when those participants were called back, the judges would then look at them, evaluate them, and switch them onto a different horse that they would then have to ride the course on. George's whole idea was cozying up to the judges so they would know which horses to switch him onto that he had not only ridden previously, but had shown previously. And George even says that, yeah, the judges knew which horses he had a history with. And then following in the same year, he set his sights on the Henry Berg Trophy, which was a year-end awards based off of points at the end that you accumulated at different shows, and George won it. However, once again, it wasn't a squeaky clean win. See, he rode a pony that would do the course once, but if asked to go into the ring again, it would pretty much rear straight up and it would absolutely refuse. And during those shows where he would rack up the points for the Henry Berg Trophy, participants would ride the course. The top two riders would then be called back to switch horses and then ride the course again on a new horse. George intentionally rode that pony so that way the girl that was his biggest competition couldn't ride the horse when they came back through to switch rounds because the pony would just rear straight up. And like, he intentionally picked that pony. He had other horses he could have ridden at that time, but he intentionally picked a pony that he knew would rear up on the girl coming after him so that way she couldn't ride the course they were required to ride.
And this is where that disclaimer comes in, where like, on like one story at a time, it's kind of funny, right? Like, if this is the worst he ever did, it's kind of funny. As like a 15-year-old boy, you know, this
it is. I mean, it's clever, it's funny.
But this is not the worst he did. This is like the best he did.
It just goes to kind of start establishing that pattern of constantly rubbing elbows to get in good graces of judges or other officials. And this is something you see as a pattern throughout George's entire life, even when he is on the USCT and dealing with the national teams. Like, this is something he continued on. It's not just something that happened when he was like 15 and wanted to win a trophy.
But I mean, it's not just that. It's also that winning comes first. Winning will always you win at all costs. You succeed at all costs. The horse, the team, everything else is much lower on the importance scale. Winning is first, and you do it by any means possible.
Yes. And on that same kind of mentality of winning by any means necessary, it was between 1955 and 1956 where George set his sights on becoming serious about making the USET, which is the United States Equestrian Team, and he began taking note of what other methods riders at the time were utilizing to, I guess, get a competitive edge, which includes practices such as polling, which I always thought was called wrapping, or using a tack pole, which is essentially a jump pole with nails sticking out of it. So if the horse were to brush up against it, it's very painful. And he also mentions the use of bell drops, a medication that was typically used to treat colic, but you put a drop of it on your horse's tongue and it makes them extremely hyper and just jumping out of their skin. And it's the way he mentions these things and brings them up, especially with the bell drops. He talks about it in such a way that I think this was probably one of the first of many instances where George started doping his horses and using drugs to give his horse an edge. In 1956, they also were holding the Olympic trials. And as the Olympic trials, which George was preparing to go and compete at, that way he could try his hand at getting on the United States Equestrian Team, he decided to travel to Mexico City to study and ride with General Humberto Morelos Cortez. While there, George was watching while Morelos trained his students. He rode with him. He got a ride through different gymnastics and grids with him. And George became fascinated, or I guess kind of fixated, on this one gymnastic grid that was used with cemented telephone poles in place. So a very fixed in place jump, no give, no nothing. And it like included bounces. I think it was like 4 feet high or something. One evening, while watching Marilla's students go through this grid, a young rider was killed after suffering a rotational fall. You would think that like after you watch that, you'd be like, huh, maybe fixed grids aren't the greatest idea, especially since he just watched someone die doing it. But nope, George actually ends up bringing that grid and building his own version of it in college, which that's weird.
It's so weird. Like this whole, there's so many parallels. Like everything you're saying, I'm basically going to repeat in the second half, part two. Like everything just continues to happen over and over again. Like he makes no changes. It like blows my mind.
Yeah, he makes no changes. And as well, when you're reading through his book, he tells these stories with zero reflection on them. Like you can tell these stories. They happen. It happened at a different time. You're not the one that set up that grid and watched someone die.
Yeah.
But then you talk about how unsafe it was and how like you changed something. You talk and you go in about it a little bit further. You don't say how you turned around and set up your own grid, same style, built your own in college.
Yeah, that is, yeah, something huge that's missing from his book is there is zero reflection on anything that happened. I think in the 90s, when you read from the 90s to the end, he gets a little bit more reflective. But most of these stories he's telling in the beginning, as horrible as they are, they're still jokes to him. Like he still thinks these are hilarious moments and that like, would do it again, most likely.
And his friends, like the interviews, the little anecdotes that he grabbed from his friends to share, they tell kind of horrendous stories as like a jokey, funny story.
Yeah.
One of which I'll share right now was during 1956 when the Olympic trials were happening, George went to try on. And due to his success early on in the jumping world, the head of the Olympic Committee, this is yet another instance where he's rubbing elbows with someone. The head of the Olympic Committee, his wife, had taken an interest in George and went so far as to offer him a few of her own horses to ride in the Olympic trials, which he did. He came in second in those Olympic trials. They chose not to put him on the team at that time because he was untried. He'd yet to jump in Europe. And to take the unethical behavior a step further, I'd like to read a brief story by one of George's own good friends of during those Olympic trials. It goes as such. One day, I noticed a jump pole sticking out of a long, narrow pile of straw and shavings in the manure pile near George's barn. I mentioned it to Charlie and we decided to have a look. It was a normal length show fence pole with hexagonal-like cuts on the edges. For a width of about 4 inches, down the length of the entire pole were dozens of nails that had been hammered in and snipped down very short. It was a tack pole, and a very substantial one at that. I couldn't believe it. here was the equitation champion of America, the nation's golden boy, with a tackpole hiding in his manure pile. Not only was he rubbing elbows to get a leg up and be riding different horses for the Olympic trials, but he was also using abusive techniques to get his horses jumping better.
No, I mean, that is extremely dangerous, and I don't even think, like, leg protection for horses was invented in the 50s. Like, so it's not even like it's going to knock on a boot or something. You're cutting your horse.
And George has no sympathy for the horses he's using these methods on, because during those trials, George's horse actually refuses at one of the fences after he overjumped the horse the previous day. And George sold him right after the trials. Like, this was his main horse that he was riding consistently all the time, rides him at the Olympic trials. The horse stops once, and he says it was because they were no longer clicking. But the whole lead up to him telling about how he sold the horse, the reason felt more like it was because the horse stopped jumping due to being jumped to exhaustion and having painful, abusive methods used on him.
It was never about the horse. Like, that's the only thing I keep, like, when you read this book and these stories, George never cared about the horse. And I know that that is the big belief, that George is, you know, he loves the horse. He has this great system, blah, blah, blah. He never cared. And he shows it over and over and over. He never changes. Like, it's bonkers to me that, like, things only get worse from here. Like, that's what's bonkers, is things only get worse from here.
I will give it once again. It was a different time. Like, he was 18 at the time.
The tackpole was hidden in the manure pile. So you don't even get to use the, like, it was a different time. Everyone pulled horses. If everyone...
Oh, yeah, 'cause he knew it was wrong. He was hiding it.
Yeah, if everyone pulled horses and it was a different time, then why is it hidden in the manure pile? And, like, when you read that part in the book, it almost looks like George didn't know that was the story his friend told. Like, it almost comes across, because then he follows up with, like, me and that horse, our relationship, you know, wasn't working, so I sold him. And it was like, but your friend just admitted to, like, tricking you into over jumping your horse and exhausting your horse. And then, like, like, he almost doesn't know that story, nor does he, like, mention the tack pole or anything that his friend tells about.
And then this is kind of a relevant side note at this time, and keeping in the theme with George Morris, he cheated on his SATs. And in the grand scheme of things, that's not the end of the world. But the way he says it is, he's totally bragging about the fact that he had help on his SATs.
Yes. Yeah. Just a pattern of behavior. We're just demonstrating a pattern of behavior.
Yeah. And throughout the entire 50s of George's book, he describes excessive drinking, constant partying, to the point where he would be at horse shows and people would be having to push him up onto the horse while he was drunk and jump them round the courses. He even elaborates excessively and very unnecessarily, let me tell you, on how he was constantly meeting new friends, air quotes are used there, who lived the flamboyant lifestyle. And at one point, at the end of the 50s, George writes that, I had, well, let's say 10,000 and counting.
Yes.
Referring to his body count. And you're probably wondering, huh, that's not very relevant to the story. And you're right. Why he threw that in there, I don't know. But he throws that stuff in just randomly throughout. Like, I didn't want to know his body count, but the whole first half of this book, when you read it, it is not him talking about his horsemanship or how he won these various classes or these big shows. So much of it, he introduces people to the story just so he can say that he slept with them. Like, the whole first half of the book is him just trying to prove that his body count was 10,000, that no one asked.
You will literally get whiplash from reading, like, the first half of the book, because, like, he will be telling the story about, like, this horse, and we were training this horse, and then, bam, you're the first guy that girl ever slept with, and then you're back, like, and he sleeps with girls in the book, and then you're back to, like, okay, what just happened?
Like, it has no relevance. But he just randomly throws it in that he slept with someone.
Also, did you catch that one story? And maybe you'll have it later, but no one needs to know. Where he references that was the first time he learned about group therapy, in quotes.
Yes.
And it was like, oh my God, George, nobody needs to know this. No one needs to know about you learning about group therapy at a gay bar. Like, we get it. We get what happened. Great. That's fantastic. I'm here for the horses, personally. None of this is necessary. And I understand that, like, a big part of George's life is that he's gay and he lived in New York and he's trying to explain what it was like to be a gay man in the 60s. And I understand that, like, that was challenging and that was tough. Not how he presents it. It was a jolly good time for him. Like, it's not even... the book, like, frames it as talking about the struggles. He talks about his struggles. Hitting 10,000 seems to be the struggle. Like, the struggle is not how society saw him. The stereotypes and the stigmas. Like, it's not about any struggles that he personally had. Unless we're talking about he didn't hit 10,000 soon enough.
There's a way to talk about things like that. I mean, there's not necessarily a way to talk about things like that. You can talk about it however you want. I don't want to put someone in a box. But the way he speaks, he does it in a very crass way.
Yeah.
It's not in a respectful way to those that were his partners at the time. He name drops people that are now deceased that, like, so he can claim that he slept with them.
Yeah, there is a lot of stories he tells that I don't necessarily believe are his stories to tell. And so it does come off really kind of gross. I didn't get to this part of the book because I skipped the middle. Does he talk about Stonewall at all? Like Stonewall riots or any of that stuff?
No, he doesn't. He does briefly.
So you can't say that this is about a gay man growing up in New York and not talk about the Stonewall riots. Like,
the only real struggle that he mentions that was going on at that time was when the AIDS really started happening.
Yeah, sure, he meant,
but he also just starts calling it the gay plague.
Oh.
Yo, dude, that might not be the best way to refer to the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, that's probably not the best way. Yeah, that is, wow, that is, I'm not part of that community, but I can imagine reading these stories and hearing him talk about his struggles and having it framed that way could be really infuriating. But I'm not part of that community, so maybe I'm off base on that one.
I'm not either, so I can't necessarily speak on it, but just the way that he talks about it is just, he's so disrespectful.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole time he's talking about the AIDS epidemic that's going on, and he finishes off like his little reflecting paragraph at the end of, I forget what years it was.
80s, that would have been the 80s.
Of how hard it was for him to not be sleeping around so much. Like, it wasn't, it was just, he talks about it in such a crass and dismissive way that if this was meant to talk about the struggles of being gay, he doesn't really do that. He just kind of like flaunts what he was doing to prove how great he was.
Yeah, it's all, yeah, yeah, it's all very narcissistic. Like, the whole book is very, he's clearly a narcissist, if no one's gathered that at this point. But it'll become clearer later, I promise.
So anyway, getting back to the 50s, the late 50s, when George began teaching his first students, who were his sister's children, and he used different methods to teach them, and not necessarily always in the good way. One of them was that he would set up grids and then tie the kids' reins to their saddles, which we've all kind of experienced at one point. But then he would also blindfold the kids and send them through the grid like that, which, that's just dangerous. I mean, kind of funny, I guess, but that's just dangerous.
I mean, that's funny, like, one time. Like, one time, that's hilarious.
But he did it to the point until a girl broke her, until...
Oh, you know.
The girl broke her arm.
Yeah, no, that it stops being funny about there, but it's funny one time. We've all done something like that to one of our siblings from time to time.
And then another instance of his questionable teaching tactics are kind of just the way that he flaunted basic societal norms was that at an outdoor show that the kids were competing at, George kept telling one of his students that the fourth places he was getting in multiple classes weren't good enough and that he should be winning first. So he told his nephew, Eddie, who was a student at the time, that his horse was tired and to just follow him. And George proceeded to walk through the rows of trailers until he found a lovely bay standing on his trailer, pulled the horse off, rummaged through this random person's tack room and trailer to locate the horse's tack, and proceeded to tack the horse up and take him into the ring for his nephew to ride in the next class. And as his nephew is riding him around in the next class, he ended up only placing fourth, by the way, which was what he was getting on his own horse.
That's hilarious. Only got fourth.
On this very clearly stolen horse, the horse's owner, of course, notices and recognizes her horse in the class and, like, reasonably becomes upset and irate at the fact that, like, she's watching her horse be ridden in the arena by some random boy. And so she starts shouting. She, like, catches them when they exit the arena and is, like, shouting that, like, thief, this boy stole my horse. And George, instead of apologizing, says, is this your horse? The woman replies, yes, it is my horse, and this boy has stolen him. George responded, your horse is a nag. a nag. Eddie, get off this loser immediately.
I mean, this story is hilarious, but like, whoa.
But like, he stole someone's horse, then gaslit the lady into like, your horse sucks.
Yeah, no, it's the man's crazy and should be locked up at this point and like taken away from small children at this point. The story is hilarious. Like, wow.
It's funny.
It's funny.
I would never do that. Not even when I was 18 would I have ever, which was like, I think George was like, he was 19 when that happened. Never once would I have ever considered pulling someone's horse off their trailer at a random horse show.
Nope. Nope. I don't even pet random people's horses because like that's a, nope. You don't even pet them without permission.
Right. Just to have the gall to do that. Like, holy cow.
Well, and then all the people around him, because right, like the mom was there and she was like, shh, be quiet. Don't like, don't make a scene. Shh. And like, his own sister was enabling this behavior as well.
It's also worth noting that in the year 1957 was when George began traveling to California to teach clinics regularly and hang out with one Jimmy Williams.
Yikes.
It was in 1958 that George was put on the United States equestrian team after spending the winter training at Tryon, where he knew Bert and Emothy would pick his final team from. He ended up flying overseas to Europe that year with the USET. At the end of the 50s, George kindly informs you, on this trip throughout Europe, the constant partying and meeting new friends, he picked up an STD.
Yes.
And you, and like, this is just another example, he's talking about something else and he just drops this in and is like, those red penicillin pills really helped me make some of the top shows that year.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he just changes the subject and you're like, what?
Yeah, total whiplash. If you want to buy this book, I highly recommend it. You'll be very horrified, but buy a used copy. Just going to throw that out there.
Buy a used copy. Don't read the reviews because only apparently one other person in the Amazon reviews has actually read this book. Everyone else is like...
Everyone thinks this is a great book, and I'm terrified that we did not read the same book.
I know, because the book I read is awful. 1960 was George's third year on the USET, and that was the year they spent prepping for the 1960 Rome Olympics. This was also the year where he won the Aachen Grand Prix, which is a very big win in his book. And shortly after his big win at Aachen, the Olympics took place in Rome, where the team won silver. Oddly enough, though, after the summer of 1960 and winning silver at the Olympics, George decides to leave the USET and horses entirely, and instead pursue an acting career and embrace the nightlife even more than he previously had been. He made a note that when he went to leave the USET, it wasn't due to him doing anything illegal. He specifies that in his book. He also mentions, however, at a show in Belgium, that George and Bill Steinkraus were the only two that had clean rounds in the Grand Prix, leading them to face each other in the jump-off. At the time, Bill Steinkraus was riding one of Elio Sears' horses, and Bert Demnemethy wanted to make a good impression on Miss Sears and in turn asked George to hold back in the jump-off because he wanted Bill to win. He claims this is one of a few different moments between him and Bert Demnemethy that ultimately led to George leaving the USET in 1960.
I could imagine Bert like pulling him aside and saying like, come back when you grow up. Like, you know, like, I can't put up with you, right? Because he's a military man, right? Like, it's very strict and very regimented. And I can imagine, and this is total speculation, there being a conversation that says, come back when you grow up because you're not mature enough to be on this team.
The way he left the team in 1960, I don't think it was as smooth as him just saying, bye, I'm going to go do acting now. I think there was a lot more going on. He just kind of like glosses over that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So from 1961 to 1962, for all intents and purposes, George tried to become an actor. However, that career path was tragically cut short when he discovered he had a gap in his vocal cords that would periodically cause his voice to go out. So as George began making his comeback into the horse world and popping back up riding at various shows, he experienced his first suspension from recognized events in the USET, or USEF, which, I don't know about you, but I never knew prior to being banned from safe sport that George had been suspended multiple times from USEF.
I'm shocked.
I know. How could he? Oh, my God.
I actually am shocked because that's never.
Me too. I was.
They're pretty hidden. Like, those suspensions are pretty well hidden.
Actually, this first suspension from 1963, I could not find any external sources talking about it. All I could find was George sharing what happened in his book. I had no idea about it. And looking it up, I couldn't find anything on it because I don't think he ever appealed the suspension. I don't think he ever fought it. I think he just took the suspension and went with it. And so there's no like court case records of him appealing it or anything of that nature. But according to George, he was at Piping Rock Horse Show riding his horse Big Line at the time. He went clear in the first round, and before going back for his jump off, he decided to take Big Line out along the trails around the facility where he knew there was some warm-up jumps. Walking along the trails, he came across a jump that someone had strung a wire across. George, in his infinite wisdom, figured it was a relatively harmless jump, and after all, he hadn't devised his plan himself. It was just one tempting jump, and he thought he'd jump his horse Big Line over the fence one time, let him brush across the wire, which would surprise the horse, and sharpen him up for the jump off. As he was mid-air sailing over the fence, Walter Devereux, who was one of the directors of the USET, AHSA, and National Horse Show, popped out of an outhouse and shouted, "Morris, I caught you." George had to go to the AHSA hearing and was suspended for 3 months, causing him to miss the Madison Square Garden show that year where he was going to be a judge. And George's big takeaway from that, right, that him jumping his horse over a jump with wire strung across it, wasn't that like, man, I really shouldn't endanger my horse's life like that or endanger his legs like that. His big takeaway was, and I quote, "Just one moment of weakness can be your downfall, and to be wary of directors peeing in the woods."
Wait, so it was a setup. Like,
oh
no, because who would set up a wire in front of the outhouse? That would be the worst place to do it. You would do it at a jump that wasn't going to have a crowd or have a risk of a crowd. Now, does that mean, I think it's a, like, they set it up for a reason. If someone was hiding in the outhouse for a reason, they believed they were going to catch someone jumping it. Did they believe it was going to be George? Did they believe it was going to be someone else? I don't know. I believe there's a lot more to that story. But that's not where you would set up the wire. I wouldn't set it up in front of the porta potty. Like, that's, no.
Well, it was out on trails. It was on back trails. And I think there was just like an outhouse out there.
I don't know. It seems weird. Something seems weird about it. Then why would the guy be way back there going to the bathroom?
I don't know. It's a weird story. And there's definitely a lot more that happened because as someone who has just gone and ridden at the Olympics, I would think that when you come home and you're riding your horse around, they'd be intelligent enough to look at a jump with wire strung across it and say, that's a bad idea. Let me not jump that. So that was his first suspension that he suffered, was in 1963. In 1964, following his suspension at Piping Rock, George decided to go out and become a professional in his own right. Because at this time, he hadn't really been teaching full-time or anything because he had been on the Olympic team and trying to make the national team. And during that time, people that were teaching full-time could not be in the Olympics.
It was still for amateurs.
So George decided he wanted to become a professional in his own right and went out and rented a barn for himself and began building his own training business. His first new student he got at his facility was a girl named Kathy Doyle. Her uncle had a large number of quality three-year-olds that George had access to and would ride regularly. Even though George preached that he did not fall into the trap that Gordon Wright had of subpar stable management, he definitely had moments where he had complete lack of concern over the horse's welfare, which became pretty obvious. And George even talks about it as though this is funny, how he would take the lovely three-year-old horses out and ride them through the woods and in the cross-country fields where they would ride the horses so hard that the horses would come back scratched up a bit and occasionally would come back with splints. And he makes a funny comment about how upset Kathy's uncle would be when his lovely three-year-olds would come back with splints.
I mean, I know a splint is something they can heal from and it's not a big deal, but it's still a fracture. Like, you've still fractured a bone.
During this time where George would take students to the shows, he was also very quick to jump on judges when he felt they had come to the wrong decision. He was always very adamant to make sure that judges would notice what students he was standing with at the in-gate at horse shows. Or as George says, "I was very involved with trying to educate judges." He goes so far as to say, It is the responsibility of the experts in the field to guide judges, whether it's through clinics or at shows. Speaking up to judges when you don't agree with an important situation is part of teaching them, which I don't know about you, but that sounds a whole lot like him justifying every time he would go get mad at the judges for not placing his students first.
It's funny. I have that quote in my part of the episode, in my half.
Do you really?
Yes, because guess what, Robin? That comes back. A full circle. Like, everything that happens, happens again and again. Like, all of, yeah, it just keeps repeating himself. Like, polling, all of that is going to come back in a big way too. Like, it's just so crazy.
And it was during the 1960s that George came across his prodigy, Conrad Homefeld, and had Conrad's parents send him to George to start teaching. It was during one of Conrad's first shows with George in 1964 that George made the decision, and at this time, George was 28 years old, he made the inappropriate decision to spend the entire weekend at a show in Newburyport in Massachusetts teaching in a little black string bikini.
Oh my gosh, that was Conrad? Oh, wow. Interesting. Because Conrad, that, well, I won't talk about it in my part, but necessarily, but that story, so the lawsuit of one of his victims includes that story. It's not Conrad who's suing him. Because Conrad is a character throughout this, he'll be in my part as well, but he turns against George later.
Yes, 100%. And you can watch Conrad trying to distance himself from George throughout the story. It's very interesting how George mentions him because George doesn't pick up on it.
No, George thinks that they're totally, all. They have a huge falling out in the 90s that I'll share. And George thinks they're not friends for that reason. Oh my God, I didn't even connect. Robin, there's so many freaking names. I'm so sorry.
There's so many names. It's so hard to keep track of these names. I can only keep track of them now because I have been reading this for like the last 2 weeks. So I have heard these names so many times over. Once again, what are we doing? We're establishing a pattern. George has a few things that he establishes a pattern of behavior over the years with. One is being inappropriate with students. Next is doping his horses as well as using abusive techniques with them, such as tack poles and wrapping their legs. At this time, George was trying to find his prodigy, Conrad Homefeld, a horse to be competitive in the McClay in the Medal Finals. He tried to let him use his horse Big Line, but Big Line ended up being too hot by nature, according to George, and he says, once again, a direct quote from him, "If I medicated him to get and got him too quiet, that didn't work so well either," which just shows that like he was willing to medicate his horses so that way they were calmer for people to ride them and win classes with them. Another instance of George's willingness to dope his horses was with a young rider, Christine Feister. When they went horse shopping, they found her a thoroughbred by the name of Highclere that she apparently rode beautifully and had a great connection with, but the horse had a hitch in his gait. And George claims that the horse wasn't unsound, but he worried that the natural hitch in the horse's gait would get him tossed out of jogs. What he opted to do was he decided to give the horse 5 cc's of azium, which is dexamethasone, the night before the show to reduce inflammation, and that way the hitch in the horse's gait would go away. However, there's two problems with that. Number one, if it's the horse's natural way of going, giving them an anti-inflammatory isn't going to change their natural way of going.
Right.
Giving them an anti-inflammatory and it changes how they travel, that is a pain-related hitch in their gait. That is an unsoundness.
Correct.
On top of that, dexamethasone was not simply an anti-inflammatory, but was also used to sedate and take the edge off of horses. George's business was booming by 1967, and instead of continuing on to rent his own barn or teach out of someone else's, he chose to start freelancing for a bit. So he would travel around to different barns and teaching at specific locations each day of the week. And he was also judging regularly at different high-profile shows. It was in 1970 that George bought his property out in Pittstown, New Jersey, and in 1971, it became Hunterdon, which it was his big barn out there in New Jersey that eventually, you know, became a huge, massive facility that he was turning out all these medal winners from and was conducted major business out of.
And I'm pretty sure it still exists today. He's not the owner, but it's still up and it's operational today.
Hunterdon became a booming business where his clients were winning just about every division, from equitation, junior hunters and jumpers, to green working hunters, and had Grand Prix jumpers out there winning. And as we've mentioned previously, George doesn't really have an issue using different medications and drugs on his horses. It's unclear what year exactly this happened, but this happened in the mid-1970s, where George was using various medications on his horses, and he ended up using dexamethasone on one of his horses, a bay gelding by the name Bonnie Castle. The horse apparently developed a cough while being shipped to Florida for showing, and to treat the cough, George administered dexamethasone to the horse, which resulted in the horse foundering. And this drug nowadays has been well known that certain horses will have allergy to it and it causes them to founder. He ends up going on about how after Bonnie Castle foundered that year, but George stopped using dexamethasone on the horses because he was afraid that his horses would have another reaction to it.
Which is good, I guess. Thanks.
Well, he turned to other drugs instead.
Fantastic. Also, I'm pretty sure dex is now something that you need a prescription for. Like, you should be. I guess you need a prescription for Butte, too. So I guess you might have a lot laying around.
Well, it's worth noting that mid-1970s, his one go-to kind of sedation, or like taking the edge off his horses, dexamethasone, that he would use, he caused a horse to founder with it. And so he stopped using it because he turns to something else, which you will find out in 1978.
Is it cocaine? Does he start using cocaine on his horses?
No.
Okay, I saw that referenced in forums and I was getting really confused and I was like, I don't have time to look into this. Was it George who was using coke on his horses? But okay.
But little side note, one of his friends thought this was a funny story to share. One of his friends, Mason Phelps, who I think this is important to note, worked and rode for Jimmy Williams, shares about a time that he was riding in a 5-day clinic with George, and George made some rude comments about how he would break Mason and that Mason would never get through a 5-day clinic with him, in a joking way, but also being a dick. And Mason made it through the clinic, but he was very tired and very sore afterwards, and he wanted to get a little revenge from how strenuous the clinic was. What does he do? He slips acid into George's mashed potato.
Okay, that's not funny revenge. That's, wow.
But like, to think that's okay, that environment?
Yeah, sure.
That to him was funny. That was okay. That was the story he chose to share when he was interviewed for George's book. It was also in the mid-1970s that George replaced his old office manager, Barbara Massey, with none other than Jimmy Williams' right-hand woman, Kathy Moore. Kathy Moore is a very important person that is involved in George's life. She wanted to stay on the East Coast rather than return to the West Coast with Jimmy Williams, and she ended up taking the position of office manager and basically running the entire barn for George for years. Like, she is one of his main people that ran the barn, from teaching lessons to handling new clients, keeping the books and payroll, and organizing travel for horses to various shows. And before George hired her on, she was Jimmy Williams' right-hand person. Like, she was doing all that for Jimmy Williams, but apparently she wanted to stay out on the East Coast, and that's when he brought her on. And he says it was a very delicate situation, but he handled it all in the correct ways. I'm guessing it wasn't handled all in the correct ways. There was probably some beef between him and Jimmy Williams over him taking his, like, right-hand woman, but...
Or what does that mean? A delicate situation? Like... Did something happen between her and Jimmy Williams?
I don't know. At the medal finals in 1976, George had a student by the name of Catherine Birdsall, who was a heavy favorite to win that year. However, he noticed her horse had been a little bit body sore the day before, and he ended up giving the horse a little bit of Butte. He doesn't specify how much, so I don't know how much it was, but he says that it livened the horse up so much that he was overly fresh in the ring, which is the reason why Catherine did not win that year. To me, this is yet another chink in the armor and another instance of him using medication on horses. At this time, he was 38 years old and made a comment that he was going out and partying with several of his junior riders, Lori Pitts, Michael Hart, and Betsy Parker, all of which were teenagers at this time and riding in the junior class, which means they were 18 or under.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 38 years old, going out to parties and clubs with them. Like, he was going to Studio 54 Club in New York City with these teenagers.
Uh-huh. And Michael, Michael was one of his protégés as well.
The 1976 Olympic Games marked the first time that George Morris had one of his own students riding in the Olympics. His student was by the name of Buddy Brown. And after this Olympics in 1976, George has always had at least two riders on the Olympic team, which he talks about how he would introduce students to Bert and Timothy and those that were selecting students to go on the team at that time. And it sounds like he might have had a bit of an influence over the team and that it wasn't a very clean picking process.
Absolutely. Yep, it was all 100% selective at that time and not objective.
Yeah, so the fact that that was the first time he had a student on the Olympic team, and then every single year after that for the Olympics, he always had at least two students.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point.
Just saying. Side story, apparently in 1977, Melanie Smith, who you're going to hear Melanie Smith, Kathy Moore, and Katie Monohanahan.
Prudent. You can just call her Prudent. I think her last name's been updated.
Okay, Katie Prudent. They are his top three girls that would come in, and they were like main ones managing his barn, and he's very, very proud of them because all three of them went on to ride very high level and on Olympic teams and Pan American Games and stuff. But one time, apparently, in 1977, Melanie Smith was taking a new horse for her, and the horse came in deep to a fence and ended up falling and pinching Melanie off. According to George, he was really tired of watching Melanie ride the horse in a timid manner, and so while the horse was still on the ground, he ran over, hopped on the horse's back, kicked him into a gallop, and rode into the show ring himself and had a clear round. I don't think I would ever think it's funny to you just watch someone fall off the horse and the horse is still on the ground and you run over and hop on it.
No.
Like, it's not a horse laying down in the pasture.
That story's true because he's got students who are interviewed who have similar, not, they don't tell the same story, but they have similar stories.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, why
am I surprised?
What's his name? Anyways, he's in a lesson with George, and George keeps yelling at him, get the horse deeper, get the horse deeper to the jump. The horse crashes on top of the table as flat, and George yells at him, the clock is still ticking, the clock is still ticking. So the student starts kicking the horse to get it up off the ground so it can get back on and jump.
Oh my God. Such disregard. Like, it exacerbates that need to win, and it comes at whatever cost. The horse is such a small part in this. All these horses are such small blips on his radar.
What's crazy is that he is like super anti-eventing. He didn't come around till eventing till like the 2000s because it was such a cruel sport.
1978, however, marks the second time George was suspended from the USEF. This time, instead of being suspended for abusive measures with his horse, he was suspended for doping one of his horses. However, he himself admits to using tranquilizers on several of his horses at that time. George has stated a number of times that he likes and disagrees with the restrictions on butbantamine and azium, which is dexamethasone. However, in the late 70s, after he caused a horse to founder with dexamethasone, there was a new drug that became very popular on the showing circuit called reserpin, which is a long-lasting horse tranquilizer frequently used by vets to calm excitable horses on stall rest, and it is administered by injection.
Oh, is that the one that lasts like 30 days?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard of this drug.
This is a very... So when they say long-lasting horse tranquilizer, they mean long-lasting. Like, people will administer this an entire week before. That way they can get to the horse to the right level of drugged but not looking too drugged.
Yeah. It's apparently used in like sales, like if you're selling a horse, because then the person gets the horse home, it's fine for a week or two, and then everything like unravels.
And at the time, in 1978, this was a drug that was not detectable. Well, before 1978, in 1978, they were able to detect it. But previously, it was banned, but it was a drug not detectable on the current drug tests they were using. George, for the most part, were turned to over-exercising horses to get them mellowed out for their classes, according to him. But when the competition at the horse shows were able to halt at X and stand still as a statue, he decided to start turning to doping so his horses could remain competitive. One day, in 1978, he got a heads up from a good friend that a test had been developed for reserpin by the AHSA, And he figured that it would take a few weeks before the test was readily being utilized at the shows, and so he continued to use Reserpin on a few of his horses. George claims that he chose to give a few of the horses Reserpin on a Monday prior to Pine Hill riding competition. That way it would be out of their systems by the time the horse show rolled around. However, as we know, Reserpin is not out of their systems in a week. By the week marker is when it's at the perfect level. So that's BS. He knew it wasn't going to be out of the horse's systems. He gave it to the horses intentionally. At the show, his student Bonnie Blake was riding the horse Gauzy. Gauzy and his rider won every single competition in which they were entered. And subsequently, as they do at these horse shows, they went and took a sample of his blood afterwards, and he tested positive for having Reserpin. George ended up being suspended from October 2nd to December 2nd. He was supposed to be suspended earlier, but George was able to request that his suspension not be put in place until after he finished his tour in France that he was on.
Not the point of a suspension. Like, that's not the point. It's supposed to be a punishment.
Yeah, and you know what they said? They were like, yeah, sure. We'll just give you a slightly longer suspension when you get back in the fall.
That's not the point. That's not how punishment works. It's not supposed to be during Christmas vacation. Like,
people knew what he was doing. Ironically, at the time that he was suspended for drugging his horses, he was part of the AHSA Drugs and Medication Committee. Like, this guy was involved in everything. He knew. People around him knew. Like, this wasn't coming out of left field. This is when they could no longer avoid it and had to make the people around them happy.
And just to be clear, the American Horse Show Association, which is the ASHA or whatever, that has morphed and is now USEF. So it is the equivalent of the United States Equestrian Federation is what he's the board on. So, like, it's not a little, like, association. It is the association.
And even stranger, because so a lot of top riders at the time were using Reserpin. The test for discovering Reserpin came out right before the World Championships in Aachen in 1978, and pretty much the entire team was, like, suspended. And the fact that many top riders were suspended from drinking their horses does not diminish what George was doing. People look at that and they're like, well, everyone else was doing it. It was just what you were doing at the time. No, that doesn't show you good horsemanship. That shows an environment that everyone was encouraged and was totally okay with drugging and tracking their horses.
Yeah, no, it's not good choices for sure.
While he was suspended for his 2-month period, his students continued to show during the fall indoor circuit with his barn and office managers, Kathy Moore, Melanie Smith, and Katie Prudent. But they would end up going to shows under a different name, or like different stable names, because Hunterton and George were barred from competing at shows during his suspension. It's also worth noting that Kathy Moore, she was also charged in the drugging of Gauzy, but the charges for her were dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
1979, the Pan American Games also occurred, where his student, Melanie Smith, rode her horse, Val de la Laurier. At this time, George had a habit of riding his students' horses in the mornings for them. In particular, he would ride Melanie's horse to keep him electric to the leg. He said he would have the reintroduction of the AIDS ride. That way, Melanie could get on the horse and be a very soft rider. However, at the Pan Am Games, Bert DeNemethy actually forbade George from riding the horse in the mornings. He says he was kind of upset about this and he didn't understand why Bert DeNemethy did this. And he explains and goes on to elaborate that he thinks the reason why Melanie's horse had a bad stop during one of her rounds and took her from first place to fifth place at the Pan Am Games was either because he wasn't able to ride the horse in the morning or she had celebrated prematurely at a party the day before.
Okay, so if the rider can't ride their own horse, you have a problem.
He would even go so far as to share that for one of his junior riders, Mark Leone, he would tack up the boy's horse, warm him up for him, and only let Mark get on him once the horse was standing at the end gate. And Mark won the medal finals that year.
So, yeah.
He would do this to where he would say that, like, oh, these riders are just really good at doing it cold. They don't need any warm-up.
Nope, that's a kid that doesn't know how to ride. That's a kid that doesn't know how to ride. And there's similar stories throughout the book where I was like, oh, so this person can't ride her own horse because he does this throughout the 2000s with having other people ride horses because they're helping. They're quote helping. It's like, nope, that is a U.S. equestrian team member. She should be able to ride any horse.
Yes. Like, this is, she's at the Pan American Games. Why are you having to exercise her horse every single morning to keep it electric to the aids?
Yeah.
That tells me you're whipping the horse and you're being cruel to the horse. That tells me you're having harsh morning rides.
And it tells me she or whomever can afford horses. Like, I know there's a change where it goes from having the donated horses to the purchased horses when the amateur status changes. But, like, they could pay the fees. If you're an amateur, then you have to be able to pay the fees and pay for the training and pay to be there. If you are a professional, then you have to be able to get access to those quality horses. So it's more about who they are and what they have access to and winning than it is about the riding and the horsemanship.
Exactly. Anyways, the beginning of the 80s was when George stepped back a little bit from teaching purely hunter and equitation and began to get back into the more competitive circuit himself and riding more and really testing out the waters with the jumpers. Towards the end of 1983, because George decided he was going to focus more on jumpers in both his teaching and his own riding, he ended up gifting his hunter equitation business to Frank Madden and Bill Cooney. Bill was also suspended for using Reserpin. During the 80s, George had two main horses. I bring them up because there's a lot of horse names I've introduced in this story, but these two are kind of important because there's some shady business dealings that go on with them. During the 80s, George had two main horses. He had a gray mare by the name of Brussels and a bay gelding by the name of Rio that he really rode throughout the last part of like his really big show jumping career.
Brussels made it in the book?
Brussels made it in the book, yes, because she is involved in the shady business dealings. George also makes a funny comment when he's talking about his horse Rio, stating that he never gave him tranquilizers because giving him drugs wouldn't have been an effective shortcut. It would have just taken away his edge. Which sounds shockingly like he was still tranquilizing his horses even after his suspension in 1978 and hadn't really learned from that lesson. And it also makes me think that he might have been using tranks on Brussels. Because why specify you never tranquilize one horse and ignore the other?
Yeah, that is a weird statement to say.
Towards the end of 1983, George was competing again himself in the Grand Prix, and he was mainly competing with Brussels. At the time, actually, he was only competing Brussels at the time because he used the money from Brussels to buy Rio. But George owned half of Brussels with his partner, Dan Nanning, who owned the other half of her. He says he realized at this point when he was competing her and they were winning a lot, how special of a horse Brussels was and how valuable she was. After the Lake Placid Horse Show, he bumped into his old friend, Hugh Wiley, who mentioned he had an investor by the name of Clyde Pitchford Jr., who was a part of a group called the Rex Group. Together, Hugh Wiley and Clyde Pitchford Jr. wanted to invest in Brussels, so they first bought out Dan Nanning and then purchased the rest of her being Brussels, from George. George's outlook on this sale, while he was still going to ride Brussels, was kind of funky, and it was that, as much as I love that mare, once a horse becomes that successful and in turn that valuable, the risk is that much greater. I had turned a decent profit bringing her along and could still ride her myself, but now the risk was in the hands of a bigger player. I mentioned that because that'll come back up, and it's also weird. Like, he talks about these horses that they're too valuable for him alone to own.
Yeah, it's a weird statement, but I mean, yeah, I'm trying to figure out like a logical reasoning.
But this is getting us into the story about the Rex Group. And I remember how, I want you to take note of how he says that they approached him, old friend Hugh Wiley in 1983, approached him about an investor he potentially had called Clyde Pitchford with the group, the Rex Group.
Okay.
He says it, the way he says it is very much so like, it was just kind of an old friend who comes up to him and is like, hey, I also have these buddies, right?
Yeah.
It's not how it happened. So actually, funnily enough, that he never mentions was that he was actually one of the original members in 1983 of the Rex Group.
Oh, sure. Okay.
But, like, he ignores that part. In fact, the original members of the Rex Group was him, Hugh Wiley, Clyde Pitchford Jr., Joseph Canada Jr., and Bert DeNemethy.
Okay, so he knew who these people were. He wasn't randomly introduced to a group of people.
No, but he presents it like he was randomly introduced to a group of people because a buddy wanted to invest in a horse.
Right.
It was, like, he was part of the investors that bought the horse from himself. However, in 1984, the Los Angeles Olympics happened. Every single name on that team, with the exception of Joe Fargis, was one of his students. So Melanie Smith, Conrad Homefeld, Leslie Burr, and Ann Krasinski had all been previous students of George Morris's. And interestingly enough, it was also Bert Nemethy that built the Olympic course that year, where the team won gold.
Oh. Also, did you know it was held at Santa Anita Racetrack?
Oh, weird.
Yeah, I thought that was really weird.
However, in 1986, I think this at this time, George started to drift away from the Rex Group, because the Rex Group, who owned his Mount Brussels, gave the ride to Michael Matz, feeling that he would do better with the horse. And then eventually, guess who they handed the ride of Brussels over to?
Conrad.
Joe Fargis and Conrad Homefeld.
Oh, that was a total guess, but I knew it was Conrad. Oh, yeah. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say, oh, wow, it's so interesting, because like I didn't read the middle of this book and things are making so much more sense. Is this why you read a book in order? You don't skip the middle?
You read the whole thing. Yeah.
You read the whole thing? Okay. Things are making a lot more sense.
Also, at this time in 1986, as the Rex Group takes the ride from Brussels away from George, the Rex Group approaches him about buying his other top horse, Rio. George claims that he was in support of this idea because he felt the horse was too valuable for him to own all on his own. Once again, direct quote from him, kind of weird, but whatever.
I think I could understand, like, the vet bills and, like, you want to be able to put a lot of money in to this horse to make sure that it's, like, competitive, right? You're not just going to spend $5,000 on a colic surgery. You're going to spend all the money on a colic surgery and recovery. And George alone might not have that money.
I guess so. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. So at the time, Rex Group approached him to buy Rio, and he was totally in agreement with it. They drew up the purchase contract. They had banners, blankets, and nameplates all made out for Rio with the Rex Group brand on it. And even though they agreed to purchase Rio, the Rex Group never actually paid for the horse. Eventually, George went and sold the horse instead to Jane Clark. Well, the Rex Group, when that happened, turned around and sued him afterwards, claiming that the horse was theirs, since they had intention to buy him. The case ended up going to a court where the judge ruled that Jane Clark and the Rex Group both owned part of the horse, and that Jane Clark / George Morris would have to pay the trustees $225,000, freeing all claims the Rex Group had over the horse as well, to ensure that others who at the time were suing the Rex Group and trying to collect debts from them couldn't claim the horse.
Okay.
Later that year, one of the members of the Rex Group, Clyde Pitchford Jr., was sentenced to 25 years in prison for embezzlement and loan fraud.
So, yeah, anyone who knows anything about true crime, we don't mess with juniors. Juniors are bad news. Any junior out there has committed a crime, okay? We just don't deal with juniors.
There was like 4 different lawsuits against the Rex Group within that short little couple years in the 80s time frame.
Yeah, it's called junior behavior. We don't deal with juniors. It's like panhandle behavior and junior behavior. You just don't deal with juniors.
Yeah. So even when George was a part of the group, like, they were taking out massive loans to buy Grand Prix level horses, and then they were defaulting on their loans.
Weird.
But big moves began to happen in 1986, where changes were occurring on the international levels. Rules for who is eligible for national teams changed, making it so that unless you were teaching Olympic level riders and being paid for it, then you are considered an amateur, and suddenly just about anybody could be considered for the national team. And once again, George was eligible to try for the United States equestrian team. However, these dreams for George came to a screeching halt. George broke his femur falling off Rio during a schooling session with Hap Hansen. Hap had fallen off and George went to check on him, and as he was swinging off Rio bolted and he fell, breaking his femur in multiple places.
Ouch.
And it took him quite a bit of time to recover from it and get back in the saddle. As he was just starting to get back in his groove and competing at top level again and jumping big courses, he went to Hickstead in 1987. And even though he had a bit of a cheap shot with Rio, where he got to ride Rio around the official arena the day before, he still had issues in there where Rio didn't get quite the right distance to the Hickstead hedge, resulting in George having a bad fall. He was checked out by another rider there who was a doctor on the grounds and was given a clean bill of health by him, but he still felt that like something was kind of funny. His fingers were tingling and he couldn't see right. So he went to the hospital and once again was given a clean bill of health But as they left the hospital, a nurse came running out, tapped on their car, and was like, hey, actually, your neck's broken. Apparently, some radiograph was walking, or radiograph guy was walking by and was like, hey, because his x-rays were still hanging up. He was like, where's your patient with the broken neck? And they're like, what? And that's when they realized George had a broken neck.
Yikes.
Which, that's a funny story.
Yep, but like, again, that's a funny story.
We see how far and few between these funny stories are.
Yes. Yeah, there's not a lot of them.
To finish off the 80s, in 1988, we saw the Seoul Olympics happen. And following the Olympics, George was, so 1988, this is 10 years after his suspension for use of drugs with his horses. George was part of the discussion once again and part of the initiatives and with the different committees where the new rules were being discussed with the Federation of Drugs and Medications around drug use and testing for horses at the horse shows. So he had it in like the entire time of what was going to be tested, what new tests they were coming up with. And in fact, in 1989, George played a big role in the AHSA's annual convention with the Drugs and Medication Committee to create new rules in regards to the use of different drugs like butbantamine and ketofen, where a new rule was proposed by the Drugs and Medication Committee to permit the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like butbantamine and ketofen to allow the administration of these drugs in a therapeutic manner that would not be performance enhancing. One person that was at this convention recalled George standing up after the presentation was given and people were really on the fence about it, stating that, however, with the occasional horse, just like a human athlete, therapeutic drug use is called for because it makes the horse happier and more comfortable doing his job. Bute is also a preventative drug. And he stood up and made an impassioned speech about it that pretty much swayed everyone there in the room.
Interesting.
Which, those rules, actually going through and reading them, they're still in place today with the USCF. Those rules, I don't have an issue with. But I think it's interesting that he has such a big role in changing things and encouraging the use of painkillers and stuff for the horses, because while they always argue in favor of painkillers because we give our athletes, like normal human athletes, painkillers, it doesn't quite line up because horses can't tell you when the pain is too great for a regular painkiller. They can't tell you when it's like an acute pain that can't just be brushed off, and they also don't get a choice. An athlete is choosing to take those painkillers. The horse isn't.
Yeah, an athlete's choosing to take those painkillers and continue to compete. The horse may take painkillers and want to go back to the stall. Like, they're not choosing to continue.
And so, like, after George, you know, helped get that new therapeutic drug rule passed in 1989, people were, like, once again, really commending him for how much he cared about horses, which I think is really funny because George ended up retiring his horse Rio at the end of the 80s for a suspensory strain. But it wasn't because he wanted to retire Rio. He actually comments on how Rio had squishy suspensory ligaments and or tendons, mm-hmm. and that's why he got a strain. However, it was Rio's owner, Jane Clark, that wanted to retire him before he was permanently injured and broke down in the ring. George says that Rio wasn't any more or less sound than he ever was at that time, but he also commented in some sentence that, like, Rio had soundness issues. But he wanted to keep riding Rio. He wanted to just give him Bute and keep riding him, even though he has suspensory issues. It was Jane Clark that made the decision to retire Rio before he broke down in the ring.
So, folks, with that, I think we will leave it. That is part one of the George Morris saga. Part two, which will be out in a week from now, we'll do a part two. We'll start with the 90s and we'll go all the way to current time. So I hope you're ready for that. Don't read ahead, folks. Don't cheat. Don't read ahead. We'll inform you of all the good juicy gossip and things that happened.
I know we covered a lot of information, but I think it was really important because it, even though those are older stories, it shows a pattern of behavior and shows that, like, this is not something that just happened on a one-off. This isn't something he just did when he was younger. He carried these habits through his entire life.
Absolutely. And, like, those stories are the building blocks. Like, next week's episode, the horses start to die. Like, it gets worse from here. Like, those are just the building blocks and the foundation stories where everyone was like, okay. Things start to go off the rails in the next couple decades. Like, it doesn't go good.
It also shows how extreme his behavior was and the things that he was doing. Even though he got suspended twice, he was so just like entwined in every single part of the national team, the selection, the drug committees. He was an integral part of absolutely everything. He had his hands in everything, that people knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
They just turned away from it because he was so integral at that time. Well, it was a long one. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us and listening. I hope you are excited for part two. Make sure you stay safe, stay classy, and don't look up to George Morris.
And don't put acid in people's mashed potatoes. Like, that's...
yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. That's just a lot.